Before the war, citizens on both sides had proclaimed America to be God's vehicle for the redemption of mankind, glorifying the tale of biblical Israel and the post-independence United States as strikingly similar and analogous. However, once division came, according to chronicler Snay, the appeal to Old Testament history and the analogy between biblical Israel and the United States was far more prevalent in the writings of the Southern clergy during the secession crisis. Examining both Confederate and Federal fast day sermons, he found only one explicit Northern invocation of God's new Israel, a theme common among Southerners. Southerners in particular identified with Israel because of their self-image as a more prayerful people than Northerners, and because they shared Israelites' consciousness of being the people of a beleaguered small nation surrounded by enemies. Scripture, the Confederate clergy advised, even justified secession. The Reverend Lucius Cuthbert Jr. of Aiken, South Carolina, reminded his flock that when Rehoboam placed heavy burdens upon his people, God sent Jeroboam to head the secession of the 10 tribes. The Central Presbyterian of Richmond elaborated that the dissolution of the Hebrew tribes came not as a sudden and abrupt schism, but as the inevitable result of these chafing and loosening causes that had been acting for years. In short, just like supposed Yankee provocation. Ministers also argued that if defensive war by Israel had been justifiable in the Bible, it must be justifiable again. Because of its theological weight, Scripture could not be abandoned when the Confederacy experienced disheartening reverses, as with the death of Stonewall Jackson in 1863 or Lee's defeat at Gettysburg. Searching again, Southerners opened their Bibles to different passages. In the words of James McPherson, like Job, many Southerners concluded that God was testing their faith as a preparation for reformation and deliverance. As a Southern woman put it, "The Lord loveth whom he chasteneth." Besides, God's chosen people had been led into captivity before, by the Egyptians and Babylonians, only to eventually triumph. In Still Fighting the Civil War, David Goldfield concluded that Southerners not only accepted adversity, they wore it as a hair shirt of faith. As white evangelicals restored Southern pride and dignity, they convinced themselves that the war had been part of a grand design, as one minister noted in 1866. God is working out larger ends than those which concern us as a people. God controlled Southern history now, and as long as Southerners followed him, they and their region would achieve salvation. To reinforce their self-esteem, Southerners recast their lost war using half-truths and exaggerations. They had the best generals and soldiers, rarely beaten by equivalent forces. The Confederacy was defeated only because of the effectiveness of Washington's naval blockade and foreign politics, combined with the North's lopsided strength in manpower and industrial production. A memorial statue put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1909 bore the proud boast, "As at Thermopylae, the greater glory was to the vanquished." North Carolinian Goldfield observed, "The generic portraits of Confederate soldiers, wan and doomed, that graced white Southern homes in the decades after the war resembled Jesus in gray." As medieval townspeople erected statues to the saints, scarcely a Southern town existed without a statue or memorial to the Confederate soldiers as a permanent reminder of the heroic conflict. A new gospel was being compiled. Only in recent years, according to historian Reed Mitchell, have researchers begun to peel away myth, querying the case for the greater religiosity and superiority of the Southern soldiery, with its self-reinforcing post-1865 disdain for supposed Northern foreign mercenaries, paid substitutes, and house-torching marauders. Another Southern historian, Charles Reagan Wilson, has detailed the foundations of the lost cause Southern civic religion, an architecture of Christian and Confederate symbols held together by the clergy's post-war theology that reconciled defeat with the will of God and Confederate righteousness. Self-deception or not, what actually happened and what Southerners thought happened ultimately became a single historical process, not unlike the Bible's own origins. In introducing their anthology, Religion and the American Civil War, historians Miller, Stout, and Wilson concluded, "Thus, in the mythology of Lost Cause, the Southerners became like the Israelites of the Old Testament. They remained God's people, who would enter the Promised Land if they kept His commandments and covenants, among which was fealty to their noble cause. Baptized in blood, the South would be redeemed if it kept faith and walked the old ways, which it determined to do." In the pantheon of Protestant chosen peoples, Southerners seem to have more than matched the Ulstermen and Afrikaners, whose fealty to territory, tribe, and covenant has claimed so much attention. Their edge derives from the comparative importance of the United States. By the early 21st century, avid Southerners could claim apparent redemption and seeming triumph in geopolitical power that utterly dwarfed that of Northern Ireland or South Africa. Whether this eased frustration or whetted ambition remains to be seen. Under its own interpretation, the South was redeemed by 1877 when the last Northern troops withdrew following the stalemated 1876 presidential election. Politics and religion both played vital roles. Politics because Northern public opinion became disheartened with Reconstruction, and the Republican White House had to broker an election compromise by agreeing to troop withdrawal, and religion because of the extraordinary anti-Reconstruction determination and persistence displayed by Southern Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians. Refusing to reunite with their erstwhile Northern co-religionists, they instead embraced and kept alive what can only be called Southern nationalism.